The Making Of is sponsored by Missoma.
Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Missoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Missoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Missoma.com.
You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives, but I promise we won't be calling them journeys. My guest today is Mandy Reid, leader of the Women's Equality Party.
In Parliament, there are more portraits of horses than there are of women. In Westminster. Can you believe that?
Mandy made history as the first black leader of a national political party in Britain. She was born in Malawi and lived for some time in Swaziland under the last years of apartheid. She's been campaigning for racial and gender equality throughout her life, leading her to the Women's Equality Party. We talked about a lot of meaty subjects like racial segregation, abortion, sexual harassment, and hitchhiking as a teenager through the night in South Africa. Mandu is such a powerful and passionate speaker. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So, here we go. Mandy Reid, welcome to the Female Lead podcast. You've chosen the six moments that have made you. Let's get straight into it and go to moment number one.
Sure.
Which is winning the first prize in the working models category in a national science competition, and this in 1991.
I grew up in Southern Africa, and at that time we were living in a tiny little landlocked country called Swaziland, and I spent most of my childhood there. It was a strange time to be in Southern Africa, being the child of a black mother and a white father, because it was the twilight years of the apartheid regime. And we were living with that as the backdrop to our lives. And so it was very formative in lots of ways. But this science contest, honestly, it was something that I entered kind of on a whim. You know, I was 10-year-old, always looking for things to kind of keep me busy. So me and my friend, this boy who was about the same age as me, called Teo, we had spent a couple of weeks from a sort of recipe we had found building a solar-powered oven, right? And it was made of cardboard boxes and tin foil, and it had all sorts of kind of insulation. It was a bit of a ramshackle thing, but we found when you put it in the blazing sunlight, it really worked. Like you could bake a potato in that oven. And then this national science contest came around. You know, I heard the grown-ups talking about it, and I said, "Can I enter?" And they sort of fobbed me off a little. And I insisted. I was like, "Look, our solar-powered oven could be our entry into it." And they sort of, this is my parents, they were like, "Well, fine, you know, if you think that's a good idea, crack on with it." And my parents were kind of quite laissez-faire about it. There was a bus journey I had to travel on with my friend Teo and our massive oven. Got there, felt a little bit bewildered because it was all bigger kids, you know, who had entered, and these quite impressive, certainly to my young childlike eyes, contraptions and things had been entered. Anyway, we found our spot. I was one of the only girls. Me and my friend Teo were the youngest kids. The judges came round. We defended our invention. We demonstrated these lovely, soft, fluffy baked potatoes that were inside cooking. And I did most of the talking. And in the end, we won. And it was just absolutely gobsmacking. But it was important, when I reflect, it was an important moment because you know how at school age, segregation between boys and girls begins very, very early. But that was an example of me and this boy working together, collaborating, and producing something that was recognized by others as being worthy and of merit. Also, I remember when I came back to school the week after, there was a sort of quite a lot of commentary from the other kids about how, you know, science is for boys and all of that stuff. And I remember thinking, yeah, but we entered the competition and we won. So it was just, I think it was a moment when I reflect back where lots of ideas that I now champion and fight for started to kind of formulate in my mind. Men and women, boys and girls sharing power. They're not being boundaries or restrictions on what you can and can't do. And also just this feeling of, I don't know, pulling something off, you know, I think gave me, I guess, I'd maybe a taste for trying to pursue accomplishments, even in environments where you're not necessarily expected to show up and take up space and raise your voice.
I love it. That's such a good story. I love it. And you touched on a bit at the beginning about how you grew up in a mixed race family in a culture where it was socially and legally prohibited, really, for races to mix. What impact did that have on you, and how that, do you feel like that shaped your career?
Yeah, very much so. Although I didn't realize it. We weren't a particularly political family, but the existence of our family, because it was prohibited for people of different races to mix and certainly to marry, the existence of our family was political in and of itself, you know? And I did grow up with a strong sense of wanting to dismantle the kind of injustice that comes from intense prejudice like that. I did grow up feeling instinctively repelled by this idea of segregation. I think it did have an impact on me. It's interesting, and it really shaped how racial inequality was at the front of my mind, and actually, until much later in my life, to the detriment of noticing and believing that there's work to do to dismantle inequality between men and women. I was what I would call a late developer when it comes to feminism. I didn't call myself a feminist until I was about 26, you know? And I do think being in an environment where racial injustice was so viscerally present was a factor in that for me.
Often, until you're out in the workplace and then later when you start dealing with children and all that kind of stuff, that's just like a gradual realization of all the injustices and inequalities, I think, as women get older. And by the time they get to like 40, they're like, this is shit. Anyway.
Don't you think that the youngsters now are finding their sort of feminist consciousness at a quicker rate than perhaps we did? You know, I find that when I go and do talks in schools, or when I'm working with young women who in their 20s are already aware of and trying to tackle the injustices that have always been there. I don't know what, I definitely wasn't alert to those things, and I certainly wasn't doing anything about them until I was, at least in my mid 20s.
Definitely. So I want to move on to moment number two. This is an incredible story. So moment number two, sneaking out to hitchhike 250 miles overnight from Swaziland to Johannesburg with one of your friends. So how old were you in this moment?
1995 it was, and I was 14.
Whoa! Okay, why did you do this? Explain it.
tiny bit of background. 14, I was a student at an international school in Swaziland. I had a scholarship to go there. It was a boarding school. My family, we didn't have a lot of money, and it wasn't always guaranteed that in the school holidays I was necessarily going to be able to travel back home to see my family. And my mom, who is a personal assistant, she's a PA, she was on a business trip with her team. She was organizing the trip, and so she was coming to Johannesburg. And she was going to be there over the weekend. And I wanted to see her. I really wanted to see her. And so me and my friend Annette, we hatched this plan. She wanted to go to Johannesburg for some other reasons. And so we kind of misled the pastoral authorities at our school and said we were going to stay at our designated guardians in the town near where the school is. You're allowed to do that at weekends. And we, you know, off we went. We got on the school bus, which dropped us at the main road. We said, can you drop us here rather than in town, which is where we're supposed to be going? And so they did. And there's this main road that takes you to the land border between Swaziland and South Africa. And so we stood by the side of the road and we put our thumbs out and we got in the first vehicle that stopped to give us a ride. And it was a truck and it was driven by some bloke.
Oh my God, I'm so scared.
I know, when I think about it now, it's absolutely, I mean, South Africa's a dangerous place, you know?
Yeah.
It's particularly high levels of rape and sexual violence, particularly high levels of violence against women and girls. But that was not in my mind. What was in my mind was getting to Johannesburg because I wanted to see my mum. And so we hitched this first ride with a trucker and then he veered off the main road because we wanted to go to the border. And he said, oh, I'm actually not going to the border. I'm going to a place called Pig's Peak. That was just the name of it. And we said, well, we're not going to Pig's Peak. Can you drop us off? He was like, no, there was this moment where we knew it was like, he's got a different agenda.
Oh my God.
We need to stay on track. But somehow, I don't know, we just kind of persuaded him to drop us off. And then we got back and we hitched a ride in this family car. That felt a lot safer. It was a couple with their baby who were traveling to Johannesburg. We thought, we've nailed it. We just want to get through the border. Unfortunately, family car had a breakdown. Anyway, the final vehicle that took us all the way to Johannesburg, but much later than we expected. So we got into Johannesburg at about midnight. It was a driver of a minibus, which is the sort of public transport modem. Yeah.
Yeah.
We call them combis back then. So combi driver. And he was a lovely man. But he was so worried. He was like, where are you going? And why are you traveling alone? And we explained it to him. We're all very cheerful and jolly. And he said, well, I'm going to have to drop you off here. The place he dropped us off was a place called Hillbrow. Hillbrow is extremely notorious for being a sort of den of vice, you know, drugs, prostitution, alcohol, all sorts of things. And he dropped us off and he suggested we stay in this sort of hotel, the cheap, crummy hotel. It didn't have electricity. Anyway, fast forward, we stayed, everything was all right. We stayed there, but we got out of there in the daytime, made our way to where my mum was. She was staying at a nice hotel where you have business conferences and whatever else. And when I told her, I mean, the scolding I got when I told her how we had got there was... I was like, but I got here because I wanted to see you. But she had a different attitude. And the reason, I suppose, why this is a significant story is because it's an example of my disregard for rules. And I do think it's important to be prepared at times to take calculated risks. I do think women, I think girls are brought up to be much more cautious about that sort of thing than boys are, for very good reason. With hindsight, I think that was a terrible, terrible judgment. It could have gone horribly wrong. But I do think there's something about pushing yourself a little bit and not only looking at the barriers, not only looking at the reasons why there might be obstacles to you trying to achieve something.
And actually, part of the fear mongering for girls is a way of keeping them in their place, isn't it? You know, I mean, not that there aren't real, like you say, not that there aren't real dangers, but, you know, we hype up the dangers for girls so much. And actually, for two boys hitchhiking, there are plenty of dangers too, different dangers, you know, but we sort of try and protect and cosset girls in a different way, which then, like you say, leads to a much less adventurous and risk taking existence a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's about freedom as well. I do think the hostility that exists in the world towards women and girls curtails our freedom. And I think that's one of the ways that, you know, inequality manifests and has this insidious impact. Like I say, calculated risks are what I recommend rather than outrageous, reckless risk taking, which I think that probably was an example of. When I find myself hesitating, when I feel self-doubt, I try and invoke the spirit of my 14-year-old self.
But that is a wild story. And really, if you can do that, then you can easily lead a political party, can't you? I mean, it's nothing.
So moment number three is a different kind of moment, and this kind of took my breath away slightly when I read it. So this was 1997, being groped by your elderly boss, who was the proprietor of the fish and chip shop that you were working in, and you were 16 at this point. So where was this taking place?
By then, I had just moved back from Swaziland to the UK, and we were living in Canterbury, in Kent. Right. I was living with my father. My parents had separated by then, and I got a job. The proprietor, it was a sort of father and son jobby. So there was the younger guy who was there more often, but then his dad, who's the, I suppose, antagonist in this story, was there some of the time too. And I don't know if you've ever worked in a fish and chip shop, but you know, the standard format is you've got a very narrow counter in front mm-hmm. of you, fryers for the chips and the fish, a little greasy display cabinet where you put the stuff that you've cooked up, a till and whatever. Narrow corridor where the workers stand, and he was quite a sort of rotund fat man, and he would often sort of squeeze past you on purpose and linger as he was going past you so that there was contact between, you know, his genitalia and your backside, basically. That used to happen. If you were on shift with him, that would happen just as a routine thing. But the episode that I'm thinking about occurred one afternoon where it was a little bit quiet in the fish and chip shop. Some of his friends, a couple of them, men around his age, had come in. They were chatting, and he called me over and he asked me to make him and his friends a cup of tea, which I did. I mean, that was just normal. I brought him a cup of tea, and then he asked one of his friends if he wanted milk in his tea. And the friend said, yes, please. And so my boss grabbed my breast and squeezed it as if to milk it, to put milk into his friend's cup of tea. I remember it was awful, and they were all sort of like, you know, backslapping each other about it, making comments about my body, and then he said, no, come on, and slapped my bottom and said, you know, off you go to the fridge to go and get some milk. I brought the milk, and he just for good measure gave my breast another squeeze, and then said, yeah, and so it was very. The effect it had on me was a very delayed impact. And I'm talking about years and years later did I realize that was a very significant moment in my life. At the time, I sort of tried to just shrug it off. I didn't like it, but I thought it was normal. I didn't speak out. In this instance, I didn't. I felt a sort of cold chill in my body. I told my dad about it. My father was really angry and asked me if I wanted him to go down there and, you know, give him a piece of my mind. And I said, no, Dad, don't. Just leave it. It's these things happen. It's normal. And I think when you look at it, and when I look back, I think my acceptance of what happened, I was 16 at the time, really speaks volumes. Mm. As a 16-year-old back then, I just knew, or I had this feeling, this knowing that that's just normal. It's to be expected. I didn't really question it. I didn't really challenge it. I definitely didn't like it. And I didn't like it when I saw him do that to a couple of the other female members of staff as well. But eventually I just moved on and got another job. But when I think back, it was the probably first example of abuse of power right. and how that plays out between men and women. As my feminist consciousness grew over time and to the point where I am now leading the Women's Equality Party, I would reference back to that episode. It's in a way a real symbol of how accepting that and not speaking out if you're able to, I appreciate not everyone's able to, sort of perpetuates it. Because yeah. I don't know if he ever got called to task for that behavior, and it was a pattern of behavior. I thought it was normal. He probably thought it was normal because there wasn't any challenge to it. I think that was a moment where which stands out because I didn't. I didn't know how to challenge it. I didn't believe anything would come from challenging it. I also thought it's something that I ought to accept.
Yeah. And that's so, so interesting. And it's so much the case for so many women. I mean, who hasn't experienced something along those lines, you know, of a certain age and older? And you're so right about if you never speak up, they just keep doing it. And around the time of the Me Too movement, I remember talking to my male friends who are in no way bad guys. But I said to them, you know, at university, you definitely did stuff that now would be considered wrong. And they're like, no, I didn't. And I sort of raised, you know, stupid things that were so completely accepted. And they had never considered it until that point. They actually didn't really think it was wrong. That's the crazy part.
Yeah. And I think there's another dynamic to it too, which applies to the women and girls who tend to be on the receiving end. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of stigma. And there's certainly silencing when you get shame and stigma. And I personally believe that that trio of shame, stigma, and silencing are foot soldiers, right, of the status quo. And I think men can help us. I don't want to use his name because the chip shop's name is the name of the guy in question.
Right.
But the son, you know, there's a father and the son duo. He never did anything like that, but he was aware of it. But he never, to my knowledge, took his father to task. I think his father would potentially have listened if his son had said, what are you doing, Dad? This is not acceptable, etc. Men speaking up when they see this stuff would play a massive role in helping us shift the dial, you know, in the ways we need to shift the dial.
Absolutely. I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories. So let's go on to moment number four, which is 2008. And this is being at the birth of your nephew, Jasper. This is your younger sister's first child, which was a, you say, traumatic, triumphant and terrifying moment. And it blew your heart and mind open. So why and how did it blow your mind?
Well, gosh, on so many different levels. It was the first time I was front row witness to a birth. One of the first things I thought was, I think I should, you know, I think I should adopt children. but it was about 12 hours of labor. And
I mean, that's not even bad.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah, I think it was about 12 hours. Not everything went smoothly, B.
Right.
And it also really showed me that there's such a thin line between life and death, because what happened was contractions became more frequent. You know, pain really amped up. She ended up having to have an epidural, even though she said she never wanted one initially. But then everything slowed down again. Baby was sort of, there was a monitor attached to the baby's head, lots of bleeping. And I observed, though, at one point where there seemed to be a lull, everyone's knackered by now. I observed something funny going on with one of the monitors. And I think it was the monitor that was keeping track of his heart rate. And the rate just dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. And I remember thinking, I'm not an expert in this at all, but there was some instinct in me which just knew this isn't right. And I know no one else has noticed it, but I'm going to rush out and I'm going to let one of the kind of senior personnel know. And I let her know. And I said, heart rate's dropped to whatever the number was. So I thought it was the heart rate. And she said, what? It suddenly became this really chaotic scene where, you know, the consultants rushed in and there's panic everywhere. They've got the forceps out. There's yelling, there's screaming, there's shuffling around. My sister's looking completely bewildered and alarmed. And in a way, it also showed that there's such a thin line between fear and despair. And what eventually happened, which was this indescribable elation and joy, because yeah, things got very, very dramatic for a few moments, but she gave birth, she tore, but she gave birth. The boy didn't kind of cry or make any noise initially. So we thought, oh no, he's not survived, but then he just needed to be, I don't know, massaged on his chest. And he did, and he was all right. And it was such a relief. And it really shaped me because it was just a living, breathing example of how amazing women are. It really brought home to me how we don't give enough reverence to childbirth.
So much.
I really don't think we do. And I think that if women had a higher status in society, well, imagine if men gave birth. I mean, oh, it would be put on a pedestal.
Never hear the end of it.
The medical care would be like, you know, top priority for absolutely everything. There would be awards for people that, you know, give birth in the best way. I don't want to be too critical at all of the medical profession, because the medical profession exists in the context of the world we live in. But I do think that there were lots of aspects to it, and the aftercare, which was actually quite shocking, that my sister received. She had to stay in hospital afterwards. But there are certain patterns and trends that emerge. For example, it's now well known and understood, and the data tells us that Black women are 5 times more likely to die in pregnancy or childbirth as compared to white women. And I feel like we've known that for a while, yet it's still something that's sort of acknowledged at least, but not taken seriously.
Yeah.
And I think women in general often have their pain and their experiences dismissed. I think Black women have a double jeopardy in relation to that. When I reflect back on that experience of being witness to Jasper's birth, I don't know, it's another thing which sort of really consolidated in me this idea of how important it is to speak out. I mean, I spoke up to sound the alarm, but I also think when you look at the patterns and trends of the experiences women have in all different walks of life, and how we're treated in the medical profession as a general rule, is a really important barometer for how we're doing in terms of equality. And I think it's a real reason why, you know, our organization, the Women's Equality Party, is needed, because there's not enough spotlight on these issues.
Absolutely. And actually, your next moment, moment five, is related in a, it kind of related to this, because it's about reproduction. So this is moment number five, which is in 2014, unexpectedly falling pregnant in your mid-30s, and then wrestling with the dilemma about what to do. And ultimately, you decided to have a termination. Now, this is a really brave thing to talk about, because there is still such taboo about this. Very brave of you to include this in your moments. How do you feel that this shaped you, and why did you make that decision?
It shaped me in a lot of ways. Let me just explain a little bit more about context. So I was, I think, 33 at the time. And like, as I said, I unexpectedly got pregnant. It wasn't planned. And the guy I was with, we weren't in a proper relationship. He was quite a bit younger than me, as it happens. And when we discussed how to deal with this, it became abundantly clear, actually. It was abundantly clear to both of us. And neither of us could imagine, right, that I wouldn't be the main or sole caregiver of the child if we decided to have the child. It's not just him. He certainly couldn't imagine it, but neither could I, right? So the de facto situation was, if I have the child, and I've always wanted to be a mother, I've always wanted to have children. If I have the child, it's me who's going to do the bulk of the caregiving. It's his child, but it's on me, right? And so all the calculations I had to make were based on that premise, that scenario. And I just want to draw attention to that. I want to re-emphasize the fact that he was younger than me. In heterosexual couples, the explanation that's given for why, one of the main explanations that's given for why the mother does the bulk of the caregiving is because the man earns more, right? This young man earned a lot less than I did, and his career was in its early stages. Mine was well more significantly advanced. Yet, even in that context, there was no contemplation of him playing an active role in fathering the child in a hands-on way. And so I weighed everything up. I had plans for my life. I had things I wanted to achieve. I had worked hard in all sorts of different ways. I looked at the numbers. You know, childcare, I don't need to tell you, is outrageously expensive in this country. I looked at what was available in terms of parental leave, and I weighed everything up, and in a way, with a heavy heart, you know, I made the call that there's just no way I could honor my plans and ambitions for my life, stay sane, stay afloat financially, and have this child at that time. If I was going to be the main or sole caregiver of the child. And so it was on that basis that I had a termination. I want to just pause though and say, I know that there are thousands of women who single parent children, and I'm in awe of them. I thought about them when I was making my own decision. I was like, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I have the resilience that I see other women who manage this. And the way this shaped me was actually really quite significant, because it really shaped where I've ended up now. A year after that, the Women's Equality Party came on the scene. I thought that's a nice idea, and sort of applauded it from the sidelines. I was happy to support and probably vote for the party, but become a member and be active, no thanks, I've got other things that I'm doing. That was my initial attitude. And then I understood and learned more about the Women's Equality Party's equal parenting and caregiving policies, right? And what we're campaigning for is proper shared parental leave. And then we also have a policy for free universal childcare, right? If those policies be with a real deal, I could have made a different choice. And so really, really, in a way, people talk about, when was your light bulb moment? It was actually the moment when I realized, wow, when things like this happen, which are just part of the natural order of things, having a child, if that's what you want to do, is the consequences for men and for women are not the same. The choices that men and women have are not the same. And the responsibility isn't evenly distributed between us. And I think it really contributes to holding women back. And for me, feminism is fundamentally about fairness, freedom, and everyone fulfilling their potential. Lots of F words in one sentence, but still a polite sentence, right? I would say my abortion politicized me, actually, in ways that almost nothing else has in terms of feminist politics.
Wow, that is amazing. Because you think that that moment is going to be about choice and about, you know, freedom to have abortions, but it's actually about, like you say, the stitch-up moment, realizing how everything is loaded. I've spoken to girls as young as 12 years old or something, and they ask me, and they ask questions, do you think women should leave their careers when they have babies, all that kind of stuff. And I've realized, talking to girls, that they're already putting blocks on their ambition from such a young age, because they're anticipating having children in the future, and as you say, the sacrifices that they're apparently inevitably going to make, but they don't have to. Well, or they don't have to if things were organized differently.
Exactly. And giving our boys and girls a different imagination about these issues. Like, I would love it be if you were talking to young men or young boys, and they're asking you, what should I do with my career when I have a child?
Yeah,
so true. So true. And, you know, having children myself and having a husband who, he's married to me, so he can't be anything but a feminist. But the idea of taking full parental leave for him where he worked was just so out of the question, because of the way that other people would respond to him. It would be death to his career, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's just, there's such a long way to go with that at the moment. So let's go on to how you solve this, which is moment number six,
2018, standing as a parliamentary candidate for the first time for the Women's Equality Party. So this was the Lewisham East by-election, and you said that this was an experience that was full of contradictions and drama. And what happened?
By then, I had moved from just cheerleading from the sidelines what the Women's Equality Party was doing to be much more actively involved. The MP in my local area here in Lewisham East stood down to go and take up a job working for the Mayor of London, and the Women's Equality Party had an active branch here in Lewisham, and they approached me to be their candidate. I thought it was ludicrous. I was like, oh, don't be silly. What do I know about standing for election? If I hadn't been asked, and if I hadn't been asked multiple times, there's no way I would have done. And so, yes, I became the candidate for the Women's Equality Party. We set up, we determined priorities for our campaign, and so many things kind of were revealed to me through the process of doing that. I'll share a couple of them. I mean, one of the things that has taken me by surprise from the beginning is how much hostility there is to a movement like ours, which is operating in the political sphere, but we are completely uncompromising about focusing on the issue of equality between men and women. I thought they would embrace us. I thought that there would be a real kind of enthusiasm for what we're bringing to the table. Nuh-uh. Hostility. It was a real, real shock and surprise to me.
And how do you have the guts to keep going with that kind of opposition against you? I mean, that takes some... I don't want to say balls. It takes guts.
Because change isn't going to happen by itself. And I want to play my part in helping to create a world that the generations coming after us actually want to inherit. And when you look at what's going on now in this country and across the world, in my view, the stakes are getting even higher for women. I am scared doing this kind of work. I am daunted by it. I am intimidated by it. And that's a problem with politics because it keeps women out of it.
Right. So that's something I was just about to ask you, which is how do you get more women? You know, we all know that things will be better if there are more women in politics, if there are more women in the room making the decisions, having something to say. And we've seen, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jacinda Ardern and the amazing impact that they have made. What do you think we can do to get more women into politics?
I mean, there's a couple of things. I think that, you know, in my case, I would never have stood if I wasn't asked and asked multiple times to do that. So there's something about giving women and girls the permission to come forward. And that often takes some nurturing. It takes somebody demonstrating and communicating that they believe in you. I learned this like extraordinary thing that this is in the Tory party. I don't know how this applies in other political parties, but a woman will take on average something like 24 months before she makes the decision to actually stand for parliament, where a man will take 48 hours to make that decision, right? Wow. So there's something going on, and it links to some of the other stuff we've already discussed earlier on about confidence and about taking risks and about believing in yourself. So we can, if you know any brilliant women, you should just like plant the seed and get them to think about whether this is something that could be for them. There's also representation and our institutions and how they work. We've got to dismantle the norms that exist. And some of that's to do with things like childcare, but there's also just the environments. Another example, in Parliament, I don't know if you're aware, there are more portraits of horses than there are of women in Westminster. Can you believe that?
I mean,
I can believe it.
I can, but I don't want to, yeah.
But do you see how that creates even if it's on a subliminal level, a sort of hostile, unwelcoming environment? I also think there needs to be more barriers for incompetent men.
Yes,
so if we can balance things out so that the best men and women are sharing power. This isn't about female supremacy. I don't want to replace male supremacy with female supremacy. I want teamwork. I want multiplied by a million, me and my friend building a solar powered oven together.
And I love the way you brought us right back to your first moment, which was the solar powered oven. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was some gymnastics.
That was good. That was good. Well, Mandu, Reed, thank you so much for sharing those moments. They were just awesome. And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. If you want to know more about the female lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com or our Instagram or our Twitter or Facebook or TikTok or LinkedIn. You name it, we're there for you. See you next time.